I think as far as location, it doesn't necessarily, like, they're in major cities because that's where there's a community to support it. But that, I don't think that that's a necessity that it be in a city. There just has to be a community that supports it. So if you have 10 people, or if you decide that it takes 10 people to run a space in your rural area. If you have the people to support it, it doesn't matter where it is. You know, you could have one in the middle of nowhere if everybody in that area was into it, you know, so location doesn't matter.
Or not everyone, just enough people.
Right, yeah, that's what, but I mean, if there's like only three people in like 50 square miles, you know, and all three of those people are into it, then run with it.
Just to throw this one out to the audience, how many people here are members of a rural hackerspace or trying to start a rural hackerspace? Okay, we've got... Okay.
Cool.
Okay. And how about forgive my I don't know what the word is right now off the top of my tongue, but how many people are trying to start a hackerspace not in a gigantic megapolis full of crime and disease? Okay, so a few more. That's good. Did anyone else on the panel want to pick up the question, Farr?
Yeah, I accidentally started a housing cooperative in Rochester, New York because I couldn't start a hackerspace. Basically, I found this group of people that are like, hey, we're crazy fun people and we want to live together. And I'm like, I want a workshop. And I ended up putting the workshop in the basement. And then since they were cooking food and rebuilding the house and doing awesome stuff, I just got involved in that. So I think the other thing is that a hackerspace doesn't have to be, I mean, it doesn't have to be this like standalone thing. Being in somebody's garage, being in a business who says, yeah, you guys are really awesome, we'll open our doors, you know, Fridays, you can come and use our space. Like, you know, there's a lot of flexibility people can have, and you don't have to start all over. You can find a group that's kind of similar, has some of the same values, and work with them.
Also, the person who owns the space has to be really mellow.
Yeah, so there's the hackerspace design patterns. One of the patterns is about a sense of propriety of ownership. So if one of the members is a landlord, even if it's an incredibly mellow, cool person, some of their priorities might take priority over what the rest of the membership of the hackerspace might be, so there might be potential conflict. It doesn't mean that it can't be resolved, but there's a lot of situations that are ripe for conflict in there. So the design patterns aren't rules. They're patterns for what has worked and not worked in a quarter century of hackerspaces in Germany. So there's a lot of experience behind it, but there are many hackerspaces that exist that violate these patterns. But to do so, you should do so consciously. If the only barrier to starting a space is you can't find one, but this person's offering you their garage, why would you not do that?
Yeah, Alex, go ahead.
Like having a hackerspace is better than not having a hackerspace. So if that's the only thing, but know that going into something where it's at somebody's house or something like that brings with it a whole bunch of other problems that you wouldn't necessarily have if it was starting from scratch someplace else.
Alex, you've been jumping in to get.
Yeah,
go ahead.
One of the issues that we're dealing with is where to actually have the space. And if you're trying to start one up, looking to your local universities, your community colleges, libraries, those are all public facilities. And if you're able to become a nonprofit organization, which without the 501c3 stuff, just a nonprofit in your state, you'll be able to get free access to that. Just, you know, I guess don't have weird law enforcement subgroups calling the school about hacking terrorist networks and you'll be okay. But for the most part, you take advantage of public facilities and also reaching out to local businesses because they've been more than helpful with us.
Cool. We're going to throw it back out to the back, right?
Okay. Go ahead. Good evening. I'm curious how much entrepreneurship there is in the hackerspaces and whether that causes any problems.
Actually, we have a rather large and successful business that's been growing out of our space for about a year and a half, I guess, now. It started out in an extension of the RepRap project. One of our founding members, Zach Hoken, was the lead research guy for the RepRap Foundation. One of the members in the audience today is actually one of the founders of what's called MakerBot Industries. And MakerBot started out inside of NYC Resistor using NYC Resistor resources, most notably our laser cutter. In the early days, it wasn't a huge problem, But as they became more and more successful and start growing, and demand for their printers grew, in our little space, we suddenly had a large amount of wood piling up in our wood room, and so then suddenly they had interns that were running the laser 24/7. So over the years, I guess they ended up finding their own space, moving their own wood out there, storing their own stuff, and eventually carting some of their larger amount of laser cutting out to outside vendors. But for a little while there was definitely some issues popping up where, you know, members couldn't get access to the laser because they were waiting for a two-hour run to finish. And then just as that finished, one of their interns would, you know, sneak in there and quickly replace it with another two-hour run. And it definitely got on people's nerves and was definitely an issue. It did get to the point where I think people were starting to, you know, really draw some concern. But in the end, I think when they finally did, you know, get their own facilities, it quickly went away as a problem, and now we're in the same building as they are. They actually found our new space for us. So that ended up being a great thing for us, and our relationship has never been better. They're great guys, and they're still members.
So we have that from the other perspective, is that we have a member who started a company and had a bunch of the fact that he became a member and had a space to put it was an excuse for him to go get a bunch of equipment. So he wasn't coming in to use our equipment. He brought a mountain of equipment with him that then the rest of the space can use as well as sort of like his contribution to it.
Yeah, I have to agree. MakerBots definitely contributed a large amount of equipment and resources, even technology and just expertise and visitors.
Joy, since you're in an incubator, do you think that entrepreneurship sort of influences your space? Does that have an impact, you think?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because there are four or five other companies in the space that we're working on, and they're starting up their own businesses, and we also have an entrepreneur in our group who is hosting the servers for Heatsink Labs. So we all collaborate. I think we bring something to Gangplank, which is where we work, and then they bring something for us, which is free space.
And Mitch, you want to wrap it up?
Yeah. So I make a living off of my personal project that became popular. And at NoiseBridge and everywhere I go, I encourage people to quit their jobs that they don't like and in favor of doing something, you know, making time to explore what you love. If you find yourself in a position where you're doing something you don't love, you know, when you want to quit your job, you know, see me. But at NoiseBridge, I do this a lot. And many people at NoiseBridge now use NoiseBridge as one of their resources for their own kit business or using computers there with sort of like a co-working space where people can be in community while doing their work. And this has not been a problem at all at NoiseBridge. We have 5,200 square feet, and we've not outgrown that at this point. So I see hackerspaces as a way of all of us freeing ourselves from the yoke of cubicle living.
Okay, next question.
For you people at the hackerspace. Johannes, do you remember me? 08, Vienna? Do you know Hans Narada? The guy who at the tech museum where I gave a talk?
Yeah.
Just want to say hi. Okay, the challenge is this. Come to at 1 o'clock in the Morse room tomorrow. I'm going to put out a challenge to anybody who wants to work with me on this idea. Enough said. Just be at the 1 o'clock at the Morse room.
Thank you, Mr. Crunch.
And in back?
First of all, I had our solution for the smoking room was we just built an arcade and put a couple of really comfy couches. It worked pretty good. So, because we're no drinking, no smoking in our lab. But like most of the stories I've heard, when we started off, we had a big meeting and a bunch of people were excited. And then all the who's going to be this position and who's going to do this and all the rules came in. And most people are like, all right, we're done. So just two of us ran out and started it. But the problem is we do need people to do the treasurer role and manage all that stuff. So I guess we're not quite like NoiseBridge. We're not completely, you know, free love, but we don't really have a rule structure or a, you know, ladder of members and all that stuff. So you guys have any suggestions for trying to keep that simple and make sure it gets done, but not, you know, regimental?
Carlin, did you want to take that one?
Well, I think some of it is, particularly when you're starting it, be prepared to roll up your sleeves and do a lot of the work yourself, and hire a maid. I say that's sort of funny, but it's really, I think we're trying to have as few supposed to's, like who's supposed to do this, who's supposed to do that. We're trying to keep it as low infrastructure as possible. My being out of town for 3 weeks is probably going to make some changes, and maybe Sean being out of town for a little while. And one of the things we're trying is all like getting things done and all that, little note cards and a bulletin board and stuff like that. And also, you know, being a little lower maintenance. About like what really has to get done, like if you're paying your rent and you're paying your insurance and you're paying the things that need to get paid. If the membership, if you're really open and inclusive of the membership, if they want it, they'll make it happen. You've got to be really clear, like that it is sort of a wiki kind of organization where, you know, you're not telling them what they can or cannot do with the space. Like we've got some great members. One just started Radio Monday because he was really interested in all things like ham radio or Wi-Fi or XB or whatever. And so he started Radio Mondays. He didn't ask permission. He just started it. Another member wanted to have a handmade music night. He didn't ask permission. He's like, basically, I want to do this. Let's pick a night. I mean, and so, and making sure that the posture of the people who are in charge, even if they're not in charge, they're just getting shit done. And if you want to get shit done and you can do it better than them, you can do it. And so making sure like that sort of posture like is clear that you're all trying to reach, you're all just creating a community and no one is more important or less important, but you know, the duocracy. And just if you want to see something happen, make it happen.
Yeah, I think one example, it's like the fact that the members being interested in making happen is important. Because there was a bunch of stuff when we opened up that were like, oh, this would be good for a hackerspace to have, so let's do this. But nobody was really passionate about it, and nobody cared, so they all just stopped hopping instantly. Some of them never even started before the meeting. So it was really like, you know, we were going to have Saturday craft or noon. It was going to be awesome. We had this like great name, but nobody at the space gave a shit about crafts, so it never ever happened. And so yeah, sort of deciding like, what really needs to happen, what do we want to happen, and what doesn't really matter if it happens or not.
Also, administration-wise, I'm sure this is different in the beginning, but 4 years in, I, as a chairman, have good experience with having a board that tries not to do things.
Important.
It works for me.
Next question.
Hi, this is a little related to the previous question. I'm a member here at Alpha One Labs, and I was wondering if any of you have found a way to use the community to move the projects forward. We have a lot of great ideas, and we have a little bit of a difficulty going from, oh, this is a great idea, we talked about this, and five people are into it, to actually getting it to kind of move forward. So.
What I've found that really works well is for one person to take charge and then just ask everyone, can you help me do this? Can you help me do that? I need this done by, you know, this time, or and a lot of the times a set date is not a good way to do it, but maybe an event that's coming up. So we're having an open house in a couple weeks. Can we get this project done by then? You know, what do you need me to help you with? What type of, you know, resources do you need? Do you need, you know, someone else? Whatever it is, just you kind of need somebody to take charge and ask those questions.
Well, I think we were talking about this earlier on, like the overall driving force of the hackerspace is it, for us and for the ones I'm involved with anyway, is that it's like something fun, you know, like we want to have fun and we want to enjoy it. So if it doesn't matter how good an idea is, if it's not good enough that somebody in there wants to sort of be the driving force on it, like if you're like assigning people to do things, like that's not necessarily fun, you know.
Unless you call them ninjas.
Yeah,
no,
if you
seriously.
Come up with a cool name for them, that's okay.
We recently one of our members has taken on the role of the sign ninja, and as soon as we started calling him the signage ninja, like all sorts of cool things started showing up on our walls. I am not kidding; it's the greatest thing ever. It's call people ninjas.
Yeah, and I've said this earlier, but you know, at Noisebridge, it's anarchy, and it really works for us. So if someone's really passionate about something and they want to do it, they just go ahead and start. They can get other people involved by talking on the email list, on IRC, in person. recruiting any way they can. If other people are interested, it takes off. Like our near space balloons, there's two groups at Noisebridge that started just because one person said, wow, look at this, this is really cool. And now there's two groups sending balloons up into space and taking snapshots of the planet. And, you know, these are things that take off. And some other things that were really cool, kind of like at Crash Base, you know, they're cool ideas, but there was never any enough people to make it coalesce, and you just have to let go of those, and that makes room for whatever's next.
Real quick. Pretty sure you may have been referencing our list of 150 ideas that we have on the project page. And we were talking about giving things priority. Like, this is going to be an idea that's going to happen, and this is going to be something that we're not gonna even going to do. So I think that is also an important factor of making things happen.
And one thing that we also do is every single meeting, we have something to do. Trying to get the space, we meet biweekly. And every meeting, there will always be a set scheduled event that's promoted for 2 weeks. And that will generates a lot of interest, and it grows the space, because people will, they'll send the invites out that they're getting on the social networks to all their friends. And it really grows things very quickly.
One thing that worked out for us well, last year we had our third birthday, and we found out people like an excuse to make cool things. So if you have a reason to make an exhibition or something, offer them places for the projects and a deadline. And suddenly there might be five more projects happening before the deadline that didn't exist before. So that's cool. And another thing, anything space related, ban the phrase "someone should" and replace it by "I will," and things, at least discussions about projects, will become bearable. We've had this for a while, and
yeah, I can't agree with that more. telling people like that's or just like someone should do this is like the worst possible thing that can happen.
All right, cool. Thank you. Those were actually, I thought that was a really great question and answer session. How many else thought that was a good one? Thank you. And we're going to the back this time.
Yeah, hey. This question's for OpenFly. OpenFly, your hackerspace only attracts gay men. And yes. I wanted to open a hackerspace for fat goth chicks. What do you suggest?
Well, okay. This is a tough one. As a gay man who's totally into fat goth chicks, my suggestion is the first thing you're going to want to do is turn out the lights, throw on some like KMFDM or something, or maybe just straight Depeche Mode. You're going to need a lot of drugs. A really bad DJ. He's going to need to be well over his prime. Maybe a little creepy looking. I will not condone making fun of other members of the panel while I'm up here. Maybe later in private. However, I would like to point out the young lady who asked that question will be presenting at DEF CON, and she has a pretty good talk, and you should definitely go.
Next, hopefully serious question.
I was wondering if anyone on the panel, the organizations that you represent, if any of you identify yourself as something other than a hackerspace. Recently at my hackerspace in Chicago, we've had discussions about using other terms like makerspace, community workshop, mainly around the challenge of discussions with possible sponsorships and the term hackerspace and how people initially react to that. So was interested to see what the panel thinks about the term and if it's important and what it means and what you're using.
Jim, do you want to take this one?
I would. I don't remember what phrase we use, and I was actually trying to look that up quick on our website. But
we've used both. We had this issue early on when we were forming if we were going to be a makerspace or hackerspace, we were thinking, let's be a makerspace because we want to appeal to everyone and sound good. And then I said, let's be a hackerspace because we want to do that too and break stuff. So
I think it's really important to own the word hackerspace, actually. I'll say collaborative workspace, I'll say makerspace occasionally, but I think it's really important to keep using the phrase hackerspace and really be what you are and then have that fill the word.
Because it's actually... Yeah.
It's more widely used. It's a widely used term.
Yeah. And it's actually a good thing that the term hacker gets some kind of redefinition of what it is. Yeah.
Yeah. We've kind of taken the posture of using hacker as much as possible, and when anybody responds with any kind of question or hesitation, we blatantly make fun of them for believing Hollywood movies and stuff. We're like, this isn't like that crap. This is actual hackers, And then we sort of it opens a chance for us to explain what hackers do, which sort of makes things better for everybody.
Yeah, we've had the idea of you say hackerspace and you look for that twitch. And if you see that twitch, don't take a breath. Just say, it's a space where you build and make really cool stuff.
Yeah, it's a community space. Yeah. And, if we're spending a lot of our energy or any of our energy worrying about what some mythical other might think of us, then we're doing a disservice to ourselves and the mythical other. So by owning the word hacker and hackerspace, NoiseBridge has generated an incredible amount of very positive press in the mainstream. And you just wrote an article that fits in with that as well about hackerspaces. So if we keep putting it out there, and there's so many examples of so many of us in this room doing positive things for ourselves and the people around us in the world, the people take notice, and hacker is becoming more positive as a result.
I also think that some of those other terms imply something else, and might attract a different sort of person. There's sort of, tech shop, where you can sort of become a member, and it doesn't, you're not expected to interact with the community at all. You just go and you sort of use the tools and everything. And so I think, trying to, incorporate those terms to make things more, friendly media-wise attracts people who aren't necessarily interested in a community. And I think that a community is a huge core part of a hackerspace and attracts those sorts of people.
So at NYC Resistor, we had an early member named Dino Dizovi. He's a very talented security researcher. He ended up leaving the group for different reasons, and he's now he runs in a NYSEC meeting on Tuesdays in the during the month. I forget which week of the month it is, but early on, we lost a lot of our good software, specifically software talent, and we became more focused in hardware. And I think that's kind of a negative side. That's kind of the problem with being a maker space, is you kind of chain yourself more to the maker culture, which has differentiated itself in the past from the hack culture. O'Reilly originally had hack and a make different blogs. The hackerspace kind of is all-inclusive in a way. I understand that it may have some derogatory terminology, but I think we're changing that. I like the idea of this omni-culture that consumes all things and allows for the reuse and reappropriation and this mix of cultures and reuse of technology in different ways by different people, regardless of soft or hard.
Actually, most projects I know are sort of a hybrid of hardware and software and stuff like that anyway, so those boundaries are blurring.
And craft and art and whatever.
Craft and art, and you've got to know a little bit about everything.
We had a good portion of makers in our hackerspace while we were at FIU, because we had the infrastructure there to support. We had tables, we had soldering irons, we had all the facilities of the school. When we moved, they kind of stayed behind because there's just really no room for that at a pizza mansion. But regarding the use of the word hacker and hackerspace. A lot of the research that HackMammy does is very much in the realm of studying techniques of unauthorized access and data interception and malware and botnet type stuff. But it's not that we're doing it for the bad side. We're not when people hear hackerspace, by now they're associating with someone automatically selling credit card numbers or that type of stuff. Then they're stupid, and we don't really even deal with them. A lot of who a lot of the corporations and stuff who will talk to us, they understand it's just mostly vulnerability analysts, penetration testers, and they're just going about it on a completely ethical way, and that the word hacker has that as well. It's all just it's more of a cultural thing instead of criminal.
Throwing it back to the back.
First off, I wanted to say I heard about hackerspaces about a week ago, and I had no idea. You guys have been very informative, and I like this whole idea. Second off, Nick, for you, as I'm also a resident of D.C., and I wanted to hear about Hack D.C. a little bit. Everyone else has said something, but I didn't catch anything from you. But before you go into that, if you mind, the real question I really want to ask is what kind of connection do you guys have with your colleges? Because I'm really interested in going to Stanford, and Crash Space sounds like a very interesting thing I would like to find out about.
Well,
we're a little far away.
Yeah, we're in Los Angeles.
Think about UCLA, the DMES program. there's a CalArts. There's there are a lot of good in Los Angeles, but I think it's closer to Northridge.
Yeah, there's actually Stanford is in Silicon Valley. I usually call it Silly Valley because it's a silly place. But the next suburb over is Mountain View, and there's Hacker Dojo, which is a really cool hacker space right there.
I guess just to answer that question, HackDC is still doing really great. They just moved into their larger space, fortunately, in the same building. So that's cool. And the great thing about DC is that right about now, two new hacker spaces. One, DC is normally split in, I guess, three zones. There's Northern Virginia, there's Central DC, and then there's Montgomery, PG County in Maryland. Unallocated space, which is getting going, and I'm proud to be a member of this starting collective, which is going to build a hackerspace right between HackDC and Baltimore Node in Baltimore, in southern Maryland, the Maryland that borders DC. And also RevSpace, a reverse space, is opening up near Dulles Airport in Virginia. So now is actually a really great time for spaces in DC, and I'm glad somebody brought that up that I could point that out. But
thank you.
Yep. Oh, you're welcome. Now that I'm finished tooting my own local horn, we'll go back to the front for another question.
I've actually, strangely, just been thinking about buying a bus. But it strikes me that driving around from community to community and, well, from place to place and trying to form a community overnight with, a few hundred square feet of space to call your own would actually be a challenge that might be beyond me personally. But it had me thinking, those of you that mentioned specific sizes for your hackerspaces kind of mostly mentioned numbers, with the exception of Noisebridge, between 1,000 and 2,000 square feet. And that's kind of the size that the original Noisebridge space was as well, that I have many pleasant memories from. And even though the giant Noisebridge space has been good for me and my projects, I must admit I feel a certain amount of nostalgia for the cramped pressure cooker that we had originally. And I don't really know if I can extrapolate from that to thinking that there is some kind of community benefit, like everybody feels a little bit more on the spot for being perhaps more considerate of other people or other projects or things like that. But I was kind of wondering what you guys collectively thought about that, about whether, that growth, what kind of effects you expect to have from growing to larger spaces, or what you've seen or what you think might be the effects.
Just one comment concerning the HackBus thing. It's actually not a comment, it's a call for help. Because the thing is up there all the time. We started a mailing list, and I would like you to subscribe on the mailing list because we want to solve a problem. It would be really great to have something like a tracking system for hack buses, and we try to develop that. There are actually systems out there to do that, but we are just too stupid to do that.
So APRS.
You're hackers out there, so maybe subscribe to our list, and maybe we can get it working. I don't know. But now back to the hackerspaces question.
Okay, this is, I'm kind of sad that the CCC guys left. I think there's a fundamental point at which a hackerspace has to decide whether it's going to rise above being just the sum total of its community and allow its hackerspace to either become something more, like the CCC did when they laid down their bylaws and said, we are the CCC and this thing that we've created is going to outlast us. That limits you in a way. It becomes more of a foundation for a very large organization. And as you said, that means you lose that community. It's more strict in guidelines that are designed to further the CCC for a very long time. and maybe that will happen in the United States. I kind of hope it doesn't, because I agree with you. I like the community aspect. I like knowing the people. I like that each one of us is a completely different group of people who are very much born of our geographic location or the people who just work together to build our community.
I sort of like to picture the world as the Paleolithic era, and there's all these dinosaurs around. And you have the universities, they have a little tiny head, and they have a giant body. And to get their attention takes a lot, and to get them moving somewhere takes a lot, but they move. When they move, there's a whole huge thing. And I always pictured hackerspace is more like the little Eutoraptors and the tiny, you know, they're small, they're agile. They may occasionally run off cliffs or get eaten by something larger. As you look at evolution, things go from being small, and they find a niche, and then they grow in that niche. And I think that's actually what's happening right now in the hackerspace community is a lot of people have found that niche to fill, and the thing is, who's going to grow, you know, what new variants of this idea are going to grow to fill that medium niche? And I think that's kind of what we're finding out in the U.S. right now. It sounds like Germany's experimented and had a little longer history. I personally feel that if we keep the tenor that's already existed in this, we are going to keep the small agile spaces, we're going to get more tiny spaces like in garages or in basements, and then I think some communities will decide for our community it's right to grow. But we start out in 700 square foot and move to about 1,500, and it actually, there's moments where it's like, yeah, it was kind of fun to like be able to like do this and hit half the people in the hackerspace. Like,
I think for hackerspaces, it's possible to have like a specific sort of like groups collaborate. And for example, within our Heatsink Labs, there's a specific group of people called the Sync Fleet who meet up on their own time at Heatsink Labs to work on the Mir Space project. So there is still a way for people to meet up together and do their own projects. It's just within what realm and how specific you get.
Yes, I live in a not very large city where the only place to buy a power supply is Best Buy, and I currently work for a business that I have an opportunity to open a hackerspace if I wanted to, and I was wondering if it would be better to go for a not-for-profit to help, you know, my community more and giving them an area to work in, or if it would be better to do a for-profit place, and what's the problems you guys had going for not-for-profit or for-profit?
I think I'm de facto on the we are a for-profit. The benefits of the for-profit are simple. It's very easy. In fact, if you're a 501(c) and you don't finish your paperwork, you end up being a for-profit. So it is the de facto standard. Once you incorporate, you are a for-profit until you finish your 501(c). The taxes are a little bit easier to do, but you run into some weird incongruencies. Sadly, with the not-for-profit, our founders every year end up having to pay taxes on the LLC, and then we have to reimburse them after the fact. And it's kind of a pain for them because they have to file all this extra paperwork. They have to lay down this money, and they get paid back. But we have other benefits where if, like, the Discovery Channel or some other group comes to us and says, hey, we'd like to do something with you, we can negotiate with them without any of the restrictions of being a 501(c). However, we also don't get free stuff from universities when they go, hey, we're throwing out our old, you know, furniture. Would you like some? Each way you go, I mean, the 501(c)s guys can speak to it, but we've had some real benefits in terms of our partnerships and how we do things, you know?
Yeah, so NYC Resistor and Noisebridge were born out of Chaos Camp 2007, the same place, the same time. NYC Resistor with Breed and the group founding, including Matt, decided to go the easy route of getting LLC, and they were a hackerspace within several weeks. Noisebridge, we kept meeting and talking about what would be better, for-profit, non-profit, and if we're non-profit, what kind of non-profit, and should we be membership, would it be board-driven, and on and on and on and on. And we didn't get together to hack the law, we got together to hack the planet. So, so it's an arduous process, but the thing is we ended up collecting enough money just from, you know, $5 here, $25 there to get $2,000 together to pay a lawyer who exists primarily to create nonprofits, 501(c)(3) in the United States. And she did a great job, and it took about a year, but we are now 501(c)(3), and our entire entire process is documented. Most of it is now on our website, including all of the paperwork we had to do for the IRS, for the state of California. Most states have a lot of differences, but there's a lot of overlap. So no space, I'm hoping, will need to spend $2,000 to go through that process again, and maybe it can short-circuit it to a few months rather than a year. There are a lot of trade-offs for every decision you make. What we wanted to do at NoiseBridge, and I would recommend this approach for everyone, is to create a legal structure that as closely as possible reflects who you are as a group. It's not going to be exactly the same because the law is one thing and our day-to-day reality lives are another. But for us, being the hippie punk anarchist, et cetera, group that we are, being a nonprofit membership-run organization suited us, reflected us the best. So that's why we went that way. Bree, I've known for a long time. He's very much expedient. Let's just get things done and hack. And so the LLC was a really good approach for them. NYC Resistor doesn't actually make a profit. It was just an expedient way to get a legal structure up and going.
Well, that's not strictly true. According to the IRS, we've made a profit every year, even when we moved and tried to drive our costs so high that we wouldn't make a profit. But in lines with what he's talking about, I think you have to fundamentally identify what a hackerspace is. And I consider it a library for doing. And in that regard, you do have private and public libraries, and they serve different interests. But as it is, you're kind of set in this cookie-cutter mold of 501(c) or LLC or something to that effect, and there's nothing else.
No, I would actually really encourage people to move to Vermont. in some ways, I think hackerspaces are a wonderful opportunity to really sort of push the boundary. So we started as an S-Corp. We're looking into becoming a 501(c)(3), but there's a lot of stuff. Like in Vermont, there's a low-profit corporations, and there's a lot of, and in the social entrepreneurship world, there's a lot of really interesting legal paperwork going on in terms of trying to sort of redefine what's possible in a business structure. And I think, honestly, as much as a lot of people are allergic to MBAs in this community for good reason, there's some really interesting stuff, particularly in the social entrepreneurship community, that are going on, and I think we should try to push our state governments into giving sort of more interesting corporate structures. And, you can just start it and file for a 501(c)(3) later.
Yeah, and I forgot to mention, one of the advantages of being 501(c)(3) is it induces people, it gives people an incentive to donate. And when we got our space, we instantly needed a first month, last month, and deposit very quickly. So within 24 hours, being a nonprofit, we got $12,000. That wouldn't have happened for us if we weren't nonprofit.
And just to mention options, there's also 501(c)(11). You can form a cooperative in a lot of states if you're a cooperative of the members, and there's not someone owning stock in you. That's considered a state nonprofit, although it's not a 501(c)(3). So there are some other legal vehicles out there. It's the sort of thing where every state's a little different. Some states are awesome, some really suck. So I guess I'm not a lawyer, but maybe if you can Google one, they might be able to help a little bit.
On that note, we personally hate doing our taxes. We have an accountant, and I highly recommend that hackerspaces, at least for their first couple years, do get an accountant, walk through with them, make sure that you don't screw up and end up with a situation where you owe a lot of money to the IRS. I mean, you're going to run into situations where you end up owing money. It happened even to the C-Base guys with their power bill. So, you got to be careful. You want to, be really smart, build up a cash buffer, but you really want to make sure that when you go through this stuff, you have a professional sit down with you, pay them money if you have to, and, figure it out, do it right the first time.
I just wanted to say one more thing. I know that one of our members has kind of started up a mailing list, I believe, on hackerspaces.org for finances, just getting everyone who does finances and hackerspaces kind of together to talk about the problem that they're having and how they fix it and things like that.
And I was going to say the nightmare of the 501(c)(3) paperwork, it's supposedly the IRS is saying that they're going to have it, that you can do it on an online web application by the end of the year. We'll see how fast they move on that or if it's even good. But in normally it costs $300 to file a 501c3. They've bumped that up to $400 now. And then if you do it online, it's $300. So that's also something to think about. Maybe you might want to wait till they actually have it up and running and save yourself some money and do it online. Or since it's the government, who knows when they'll have it done.
And NoiseBridge on the bottom of our front page is all of the information for 501c3 if you want to check that out and see if that's something that you and your space are into.
All right, next question.
So I guess I grew up with the advent of hackerspaces, and I was really lucky to have a shop in my basement when I was growing up, so I could just build stuff. But as soon as I, you know, chose to go to college, all of a sudden the question was, is there going to be a place for me to play? Originally thinking dorm room, I ended up being lucky enough to have something like MITRES. I don't know if you guys have heard of it, but as I understand, it's a pretty unique place in a university. There aren't too many student-run machine shops that are also open to the public and something that I would call hackerspace in a university. I was wondering what you guys would think about trying to start up more of these kind of university hackerspaces that are completely self-sufficient. They make money from some other thing. We get it from working at an electronics like SwapFest meet. And like, I think it would be a really good idea to try and push this in other universities.
So just before anyone answers, I would like to point out that's actually a really good idea for anyone in a rural area. Contact your local college, because a lot of you guys do have machine shops, and a lot of them may not mention it publicly, but they do actually have, like, you go in, you do a quick training course, and they'll give you access at certain times during the day. It's like their library, so you can pay a monthly semester fee to use it, depending on the school.
Yeah, make use of whatever local resources you have, universities, libraries, you know, whatever robotics group, Linux user group, whatever's available, make use of it. You know, that's part of our community.
Yeah, the caveat on that, of course, is that if you're doing that with a university or a business or something else, there's always somebody else who can sort of pull the rug out, you know, and it's sort of like out of your hand. So you have freedom for a while, but there's someone else like kind of that controls the strings, and that's something to be aware of.
I went to a university with a computer science house, and I absolutely loved it. It was great, and we actually made our extra money for playing and taking trips by running our own computer pod, which was, you know, like a campus computer pod, but it was kind of just in one of the dorms. We were open later, things like that. And ran into exactly that. After a couple of years, the university said, well, this isn't making us money. We can turn that into four dorm rooms, and we're just going to shut you down. So I would say definitely go for that, but also understand that, you know, it's one of those design pattern situations.
Yeah.
You know, one of the patterns is stand on your own, and if you're not going to do it, yeah.
Yeah, we should really remind the people to check out the Hackerspace's design patterns, because they're pretty much out there, and Jens Olig, one of the guys who wrote them, pretty much says, no, do not do it. Do not, like, get yourself attached to a bigger institution that can dominate you in some form. So try to be independent. That's what he says, and it most of the time it actually is true.
Yeah. And if you're going to do something different, just be aware that there's a good reason why it's very common to do it one way, and if you're doing it another way, just be aware of that.
Yeah, one of the reasons why we started our hackerspace is because a lot of us found that at our universities or wherever we were studying school at, a lot of these universities have access to resources that we don't know about, or like huge 3D printers that they bought from a lot of money from the university's money, but unless you're taking a class or unless the advisor likes you, you don't get access to these privileges. So that's I mean, if the university supports you and lets you use everything that or all the things that you want to do and pushes you forward with this idea of a hackerspace, then that's great. I think you should do it. But
there is a hackerspace at a school. It's called Build. And what I, you know about them? And I was talking to someone from there, and what I found fascinating about that is that I was, what is your structure? I asked them, you charge member fees or whatever. They said, no, it's free, and you get a key, and you have 24-hour access. And I was like, are you serious? And they're like, yeah. So that's a benefit of it.
One thing to be aware of also is that universities are really paranoid about what goes over their network. So it's better for machine shops, but if you want to, like, run get really, really upset if you're sniffing packets and stuff like that.
Yeah, and as soon as you want to buy, want to build like sex machines and stuff like that, or like flame throwing robots, I mean, ooh, the university will tell you.
Yeah,
they're
not too happy when you have a box of hand grenades shipped to you.
Next question.
I was going to mention something real fast. There's also NASA has a hackspace at one of their places. Yeah, they're working with the Titan One.
Yeah, I just wanted to put in a good word for the hackerspace we built down in Raleigh, Chapel Hill, Durham area, 20,000 square feet. We have a lot of people, about 80% of the people that were at the local 2600 meetings for years are the core group in it. And there was a disparaging remark made by the gentleman to Mitch's right about Tech Shop. So we solved all of our financial and liability issues by opening Tech Shop. But the founder is a hacker of serious intent, and if we don't have a flame throwing or plasma shooting project, you know, going on, he's like not happy. So we're absolutely turning it. It is a hackerspace. That's the phrase we use. And so, you know, Tech Shop doesn't have to be like handcuffs and this sort of stuff. So it's a high end hackerspace. We're experimenting. We'll see if it works. But like I said, the people who set it up, and I'm one of the original people setting it up, we're all like, the rules are all the reasonable rules, and we're ignoring, you know, everything else.
That shouldn't be taken as a disparaging remark. Okay. I'm saying they're different things.
Yeah.
From like a public perspective, they at least we're in Los Angeles and in California where we're at, like people who are interested in tech shops was different than people who are interested in hackerspace.
Right. A lot of us did go for the machines. We went there for the machines, but it's absolutely about the community. I go there for the people. And again, like I said, the overlap between the 2600 meetings and the people that are there at Tech Shop almost, you know, daily or weekly.
That's absolutely fantastic.
And it is. It's a high end hackerspace. We're not breaking even yet. It's the for profit model. But that is one way to solve all the liability issues and everything all at once. You just get a boilerplate, you know, and then.
We actually had people who came to our first meeting who thought the idea of coming to a meeting where they had to like talk to other people was a negative thing and didn't ever come back because they didn't want to talk to people. They just wanted like, you know, access to a laser cutter.
Anyway, ours isn't like that at all.
Well, let me just a side note. Tech Shop. I'm a lifetime member of Tech Shop.
So am I.
And Jim Newton, who started Tech Shop, I think is a great guy. Tech Shop isn't a hackerspace, but there's a great deal of overlap between the two. And at Noisebridge, we recently worked out a reciprocal agreement where anyone who's a member of Tech Shop gets half-price membership at Noisebridge. Anyone who's a member of Noisebridge gets half-price membership at Tech Shop. And assuming this works out, and it is, this will probably be expanded for all hackerspaces.
Shop that we would do in a hackerspace. So I'm saying we don't have any constraints.
Okay, and then I think this is going to be the last question because I just got dinged on time, so Alex, take it away.
Real quick, what's up with the Hackerspace Olympics?
Hackerspace Olympics is an idea that was pretty much created by people at Pumping Station 1 in Chicago. And our other Pumping Station 1 people here? Yay. So, the idea is to have friendly competition to encourage creativity. And is it actually happening at the Detroit Maker Faire? Okay, so one of the things happening at the Detroit Maker Faire will be a competition of people using these toys for adults, Power Wheels, souping them up but using stock body. So that'll be a really fun thing to see all these full-grown people bopping around in those at very high speeds, unsafe at any speed for sure. Well, we've been bopping around ideas of having sort of a hackerspace triathlon competition where something like you have to create software which will perform some task, and when you do that, you get a clue of where to find a box that has a whole bunch of locks that you have to pick, and you open up the box's locks, and then inside are some parts that you have to build. And when you build them, then you have to turn off the TV across the room or something like that. So I don't know, but it really hasn't gelled into a specific date and time. But if anyone has ideas and wants to collaborate on that, let's do it.
All right, guys, thank you very, very much. I thought this was a great two-hour panel. Give a huge round of applause to our panelists. And thank you so much. I think this has been another really great panel. Just two quick announcements. At 11 o'clock in the Video Temple, we have a concert going on the mezzanine level, and your friends who aren't coming to the conference can get into it for $10. They're selling wrist bracelets right now. And Jason Scott will be doing a pre-Get Lamp presentation over in Lovelace right after this. So thank you guys again so much. Give yourselves a huge round of applause.
Nick Farr.
Thank you.
If you wanna be mine.
Blasted a ditch and then filled it. The home to the unknown household I've been living in for 2 hours, 6